This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ken Jones and Jeff Anderson. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Mike Fotoklis and Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath and 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener comments. At 9, an alternative radio, Vijay Prashad speaks about the UN doctrine known as responsibility to protect being used as a cover for big power intervention. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, your daily news magazine. At 11, on stage and studio, guest host Pamela Santos talks with chef, writer, and podcaster Soleil Ho about working creatively in multiple fields. At 11:30, it's Art Focus. That's Andre Middleton. He interviews Cole Merkel and Joseph Glode about engaging the houseless community in telling their stories with art. A reminder, during the KBOO membership drive that starts tomorrow, all new and increased gifts to KBOO are matched one for one through the end of the year, thanks to the Collin Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Go to kboo.fm and click on donate. Rosalind, good night. Good night, Danielle.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Danielle.
Give to KBOO today during our end-of-year match. Starting November 1st and wrapping up December 31st, donations from all new and increasing members will be matched one-to-one up to $15,000 from the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Give an extra gift today or become a member, and your membership will be doubled to support independent community media and citizen journalism at KBOO. Thank you.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio. The only labor radio show of its kind in Oregon, Southwest Washington, of the working class, for the working class, and by the working class. I'm Jamie Partridge, one of your hosts tonight, and the other is
John Walsh.
And we're here tonight with Suzanne Cohen, president of the 4,000-member Portland Association of Teachers. Good evening, Suzanne.
Good evening.
And Steve Demarest, president of the 55,000-member Service Employees International Union Local 503. Good evening, Steve.
Good evening, Jamie, and thank you, Jamie and John.
All right. Tonight we're planning to talk about labor against Trump. We'll assess the Trump election, its likely impact on working people, their unions, and especially their most marginalized members, immigrants, people of color, women, LGBTQ, and disabled workers. As spontaneous protests swept the country, Cohen and Demarest, yes, it's still happening, these two will discuss how labor unions can fight back. Would you like to start, John?
Sure. So we'd like to ask first about your immediate, your first reaction, gut response to the Trump election. What were your first feelings?
Well, I'll be honest, it was a very difficult night for me. There was an element of a big element of disbelief, which continued on for the next couple of days. The night itself, I felt despair. Despair it was so profound that it was physically stomach wrenching. So it was. I had a very negative reaction to the whole thing.
Yeah, it was stomach turning. I definitely denial that evening and was slow to accept. And once I realized what had happened, horror and concern, I just immediately started thinking about all the people that we should be concerned about and all the things that all the people that would be affected by this election and what we need to what we'll need to do to move forward.
So the big question, of course, is why do you think he won?
Well, he won because he won the Electoral College. And he won the Electoral College because he won key battleground states. And he won those states narrowly because white voters in those states voted for him. And I think the white voters in those states voted for him because they wanted a change. And they didn't think the system was working for them anymore. So they voted for Trump to bring about that change. I also think there was, when it comes to swing voters, I think misogyny may have been an element as well.
Mm, yeah. Definitely Trump's platform, if you can call it that, was the anti-establishment change. And that was clearly a message that resonated with people. But I would also say that there was just so much misinformation out there, and the media coverage just really wasn't thorough enough to really give people all the information they needed to know. So that appearance of anti-establishment, that message wasn't countered effectively enough with the very voters that were supporting him.
This is a labor show, and y'all are presidents of unions, of local unions, and we're all union members. So as far as union voters, union members who voted, according to exit polls, something like 40% may have voted for Trump, if those polls are reliable. And in the specific battleground states, decisive states of the upper Midwest, the polls claim close to 50% of union members voted for Trump. So what does that tell us about where people's heads are at? What are people thinking doing that? Where are union members at these days?
I think one way to look at about it is what we just said. Trump was like, I'm going to bring back jobs, I'm anti-establishment, then that is going to be a message that resonates with workers as well. And then I think there's this desire of like no politics as usual, and he offered that appearance at least.
I think union members, like other workers, are feeling they're in a precarious situation economically. They don't think they don't think the establishment, including the establishment political parties, and that includes the Democratic Party, is looking out for their interests. And as I said earlier, that the system isn't working for them. So like those swing voters I talked about, they're willing to try anything to bring about change.
Maybe just to bring up one other factor as a follow-up, I mean, a big point of the Trump campaign rhetoric had to do with not ratifying more free trade agreements, which has also been a point that labor has been making for a long time. So there was a degree of overlap between his campaign message and the message labor has been putting out, not obviously for the same reasons, but but nonetheless, there was some overlap there. So I'm just throwing that out there as a possible contributing factor.
I absolutely agree. He did pick up on some of the same things that labor has been stressing, including the negative impact on jobs due to free trade agreements. And people, because things aren't going well right now, people are looking for hope where they can find it.
So most of our major unions, including the two of yours, the National Education Association, the Service Employees International Union, early endorsed Hillary Clinton for president, and only a few major unions went for Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primaries. And Sanders was clearly the anti-establishment, working class advocate, totally down with labor unions, not walked picket lines, walked the Verizon picket line, advocated for universal health care, and called out the billionaire class. What does this say about our labor leadership that that this was happening?
So one thing, just to clarify, is I represent PAT, and for that we go through a process with OEA at our PI convention that wasn't an early endorsement. So it actually happened after the NEA endorsed Hillary. But so the NEA did early, before any of the debates happened, endorse Hillary. And for me, that was a message. You know, it's just going back to classic organizing and really building your base and making sure they're with you and engaging more. And I think we've seen this not just with the presidential election, but in other areas. Like, this notion, like, lead and they will follow, is antiquated, right? Like, that's not right. And we've seen it in this election. And really, it's like, you know, what are you hearing from people? What do they want? And what's the democratic process that we value? But just even if, you know, the votes were there to endorse one or the other, we have to think about what that does to your organization or the health of it when you're not reaching out and speaking with your members and really making sure that it's got that backing and support to be successful at what you wanted to accomplish. And I really am taking that message to heart with everything that we do. Like, where's the people that you want engaged in this process? Are they with you when these decisions are being made?
I agree with Suzanne. First of all, though, to give some credit where it's due, the leadership of My International did endorse a candidate that went on to win the popular vote by over 2 million votes. They endorsed a candidate to become the first woman president of the United States, which apparently is still a radical notion. However, it does seem that at the time, at least, the leadership thought the rules were going to be the same as they have been now for a number of years, that the establishment candidate was going to go on, would win the primary and would have a good chance of winning the election, and that the way to move forward was to, you know, play transactional politics with that candidate and with that establishment. You know, like a lot of us, they got a rude awakening to that. I also think...
Can you say what you mean by transactional politics?
Deals. And, you know, it's not that they were necessarily bad deals, but I think there were agreements that a Clinton presidency would enable my union in particular to organize workers who are currently unorganized. And that's not a bad thing. One other thing I want to unfortunately state is that I think these early endorsements were a reflection of an attitude that the demographics of the future were the demographics to ride, and that those voters who tend to become reactionary in economically stressful times could be written off, because frankly it's harder and more difficult to work with people like that. And if you figure you don't need their vote, then you can ignore them. They were proven wrong.
Right. I appreciate also what Steve, you're saying about the role that sexism takes place, like in trying to understand, you know, what would be the need to get out early. But you know, was there a need to give a female candidate support early on in a male-dominated political race? So, you know, you can only, like, guess as for, you know, reasons or motives at a certain point. But with hindsight, it does seem like gender played more of a role in the election than I anticipated it would have.
So in this studio right now, as in the union movement, most of us are public sector workers. And what can we expect in the public sector, specifically for unions under a Trump administration, along with not just the Trump presidency, along with Republican control of each house of Congress? So what can we anticipate based on that monopoly of power? And what do we know about the attitude of Trump himself and his own businesses toward unions, given, for example, what's happened at his hotel in Las Vegas, refusal to bargain with the culinary workers union, and other experiences at his properties. But with public sector employees specifically, what are we looking at coming down the road at us?
Well, I think it's...
It's only a half-hour show.
yeah, we could spend a lot of time on this. I think out of Congress, we may well see right-to-work legislation, particularly for public employees. We may see so-called paycheck deception legislation. A radical Congress might even outlaw collective bargaining for public employees, or at least at the federal level. And I think Donald Trump will probably be willing to sign legislation, all that kind of legislation. I think a Donald Trump appointee to the Supreme Court is likely going to result in a ruling that's going to set aside the right of public employee unions to charge employees they represent their fair share of the cost of that representation. As far as the president or the president-elect goes, I think what's telling about him is that he's pro-corporation and he retaliates anyone who opposes him, which I think bodes ill for unions.
Yeah. You know, unions haven't come about when everything is going perfectly well and everyone's treated fairly, right? So our job is very much to be the voice of workers and advocate for them. And union and public employees have been under attack under the current administration as well. So, I mean, not to say that it wouldn't be worsening, but we've had in our state these same anti-worker bills come up, and we've successfully fought against them. And I think the fight is going to be bigger and it's going to need more unification. But those fights have already started and have been in existence, and we're doing well, at least in Oregon so far, in fighting. And I think it's really, it's a call to arms to really be supporting everyone across our nation as these attacks probably increase.
Suzanne, I think you make a really good point there that actually the boss is the best organizer, and now we got the boss in the White House, and maybe that will help us organize better than we have thinking we had an ally there.
Yeah, I mean, definitely for education, that is, you know, the Obama administration has not been the most progressive for public schools and the public education sector, and that's definitely been a disappointment. And so, though I don't see Trump being an improvement upon that, at the same time, a lot of what we've been fighting, we've already been engaged in a lot of these fights against privatizing and vouchers and programs like that.
Well, can you talk a little bit about the move to privatize education, the move that charter schools, vouchers, and the appointment of the Secretary of Education by Trump of Betsy DeVos, is that her name?
Yeah.
Yeah, and what that might mean for public education.
So it's not good news. We're obviously opposed to this. At the same time, you know, so these conversations have already started, and now we have a candidate that is very interested in profiting over public money for schools. So Title I money was created because there was inequities. It was civil rights. And so we have schools that aren't equal, and here is funds to help support equitable education for all. And so with these charters, vouchers, privatization, you're essentially taking these federal dollars that are very much meant and designated for civil rights, and instead eroding them by using private schools. So I think private schools are fine, but private charters and for-profit money. And I think, you know, we see that with her involvement and her husband's involvement. And then the greatest concern there is our most marginalized students and what is really going to happen for them when these public funds get diverted that way.
I'd like to back up just a minute and make sure that our listeners understand when we're talking about right to work laws and what the impact will be on unions. Currently in what, less than half of the states, or including Oregon, unions and employers can negotiate agreements which establish union security, which means that everyone at the workplace represented by the union pays union dues, or fair share agreements like Steve was suggesting, where public sector workers pay a fair share of the expenses of collective bargaining, of enforcing the contract, etc., whether they are a union member or not. And right to work takes that away. That is that workers who choose not to be in the union don't pay anything, don't have to pay anything. And what we found in the states of Wisconsin and what was the other one recently?
Michigan chain.
Michigan.
Yeah.
In the public sector that AFSCME and other unions, the education unions, lost half their membership when these right to work laws were imposed. So they can have a really devastating impact, particularly on the public sector, but on the private sector as well.
And I can follow up. We've actually faced that here in Oregon because of a Supreme Court ruling that half our members, home care workers, were not covered by the provisions that allow for fair share. So ever since that ruling last year, we've been in that situation where whether or not someone's going to pay their fair share for representation by becoming a member is voluntary. And we've been very successful. Home care workers in Oregon recognize the value of being in a union, and we've managed to actually increase membership rates there. So, you know, like John and Suzanne said earlier, you know, sometimes the best enemy is a big boss. The election of Trump has resulted in an outburst of energy and interest in collective bargaining and labor rights, and it doesn't all have to necessarily be negative.
So in the days ahead, we're facing an administration which, during its campaign to get elected, voiced overt or implicit threats against immigrants, Muslims, people of color generally, women, LGBTQ folks, disabled people. These are members of unions. Many people who have these identities are members of unions. They're also clients, they're customers, they're people to whom workers and unions provide services. And what can we anticipate about the impact on these populations, these groups of folks who are our brothers and sisters, and what can be done to defend them as members and defend them as people we serve?
Well, potentially, the impact could be devastating. We know that cuts to services, such as being proposed by Republicans in Congress, and that Trump has indicated that he's willing to support, have a disproportionate impact on marginalized communities and can have a disproportionate impact upon women. And particularly when we talk about things like basic needs for life, such as medical coverage and food and shelter, that can have a life-altering impact. As far as our members go, my union is probably one of the largest organizations in the state of members or of people of color, of women, of immigrants, because we are such a large union. A lot of those people are employed performing services for Oregonians. And potentially there on individuals in these communities, you can have a devastating impact. You can see broken families, perhaps a worse relationship with law enforcement agencies. And as far as what unions can do is, I think they need to work at the state level on down to the local level to counteract at those levels the impacts that are come down from the federal government.
Yeah. I'm, you know, outraged, as many are, by President-elect's comments, but I'm so appalled by the fear that it's put into so many people. Like, you know, the argument of like, oh, he's not going to follow through, or he didn't mean all those things. You know, what it's done to the affected communities, regardless, is horrible to live in that sort of fear. And so, you know, educators encompass all these groups as well. But then also we have to face students every day that are coming in with these fears and their terror. And trying to reassure them. I am proud of Portland Public Schools. We've, you know, designated safe spaces, and I, you know, just taking stances at every level, whether it's, you know, a local small level or a state level, refusing government that aren't in alignment with our values. Or I mean, I alluded this earlier, but I'm also really concerned, I mean, from the education perspective, of the students that we'll be pushing out, students with special needs, students with trauma, like with charter schools and self-select choice programs, you're pushing out kids that don't get into these programs. And so there's that added level of educator concern of what's going to happen to these students.
And to tie all this in with the earlier part of the discussion, something else we need to do is unite the working class. As difficult as it may be, we need to talk to and work with people who voted for Trump and are in the working class, and we need to align our interest and unite for the betterment of all.
And be very clear with people that it isn't Mexican immigrants or Muslim refugees that are taking their jobs or that are threatening the security of this country, which is the unfortunate rhetoric coming from the president-elect. And when these undocumented families are, or our Muslim sisters and brothers are surveilled or forced to register or arrested, incarcerated, we stand, figure out ways to stand with them, stand by them, stand to defend them.
Okay. So, your turn, Jamie.
My turn. Yeah. So, in the last couple of weeks since the election, the spontaneous protests have swept the country following mostly protesting Trump's racism, misogyny, and xenophobia, and many led by students and other young people. How do you two think labor can interact with these young people, with these students, and with these protests?
With, you know, any election, you can't assume that everyone voted the same way, right? So, our role here is to really figure out what are the specifics that we're protesting and what are the policies that we can fight up against. What policies can we enact and put into place to defend ourselves against what we see coming down? I think that's one way to really kind of help guide, is like really like, as these things come up, including like the Secretary of Education, it's time to protest against these things that we know aren't right, and that's what we've always done. And so I think that should continue. And I think really getting back to what something you were saying is getting specific so that we're doing education in the piece, because if we're not reaching out and including everyone, we're not going to turn the tide 4 years from now. So really, there's a lot of we have to go to the specifics, protest what isn't right, and then explain why for the people that aren't there with us protesting against it too, so that we're building momentum behind our values.
I think labor can offer a lot of support to these new groups and young people that are springing up that have the same values and goals that we share with them. Organized labor unions are institutions, and so they have some advantages to being institutions that ad hoc groups may not have. We can connect these groups with legislatures. Labor unions for the last number of years have been doing a lot of coalition building with other community groups, and they can help bring these new groups and these new leaders into those coalitions.
And Steve, can you tell us quickly, because we're getting low on time here, there's a United Front Against Trump resolution that's being circulated here in Portland and in Oregon among unions. Do you have a summary description of what this is about and for folks to be aware of it?
Yeah, and let's give credit to the author of this, Jamie, who did a very good job in his resolution summarizing where we're at right now and the threats we're facing, And the resolution is that labor organizations will unite with each other and also with other community organizations to plan actions on Inauguration Day and then after Inauguration Day to carry on that unity to fight what Trump has promised to bring about in this country.
Thank you, Steve and Suzanne. Are there any final thoughts on how our listeners can plug in, get more information, or get involved in this fight back?
I just think it's important for everyone not to back down on their own values and not to be afraid to confront that. And whether it's on the national level or your own local bargain or anything like that, you know, when you accept a rollback or you don't fight back, then you spread that to other groups. And when you stand up and you fight back, you also empower others. So, you know, something on the national scale can be overwhelming, like what role can I have? But what we're doing in our small work with every day and standing up there will have that effect, I believe, in some of my role in making it all a better place.
I encourage people to start with any community organization that they're currently in. That includes unions or other community groups, faith-based organizations. There's just an explosion of energy and ideas right now. And you're going to find opportunities to participate through your community organization, and you'll end up linking with other community organizations. I suggest people find a network that they trust, whether it's on Facebook or something. That will also provide information about activities and how they can move forward. And I certainly second what Suzanne said is, you know, the way we handle the present is going to determine what our future is. So let's handle it with courage and with unity.
Suzanne and Steve, thank you. Stay strong in the struggle. Listeners, please do that also. Tune in next week for more Labor Radio. Stay tuned now for Prison Pipeline. Thanks to our engineer. Good night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio. Baby.